This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to E. Ethelbert Miller. He's the author of a memoir that I really like a lot called The Fifth Inning. Ethelbert's a poet and a memoirist and a literary activist who lives in Washington, D.C. Ethelbert, how are you?
Oh, great talking with you, Dan.
Well, this book was really, this is a beautiful book. I want to tell you that right up front, that it's, you know, the writing is just gorgeous. I think, you know, you sort of, your ability to write personally in a kind of poetically beautiful way is really impressive. And I found myself going, as I was reading the book, I was underlining, and at one point I was in the train coming back home from New York. And I was reading this, and there were a couple of places where I was laughing out loud and making, you know, comments to the book, which I think people who were around me thought, you know, here's another crazy guy, you
Right.
know, who's talking on his cell phone really loud. But I wasn't on my cell phone. I was talking to your book. But maybe you could talk a little bit about, I mean, this is your second memoir. Baseball is the kind of metaphorical underpinning for this story, and I'd like you to kind of tell the story of how you came to the conceptual framework that you used to write this memoir.
Okay, well, as you mentioned, it's my second memoir, and so when I wrote Father and Word, I tell people that I felt that I was mapping my life. You know, I was trying to tell people how I became a writer, you know, going off to college, coming of age. But with The Fifth Inning, you know, I felt that I was mining my life. I was digging deeper. I was trying to explore things that I felt were very important for me to come to some sort of resolve with, you know, and look back at. Like, for example, what type of father was I? What type of husband was I? How was I dealing with failure in my life? So I felt there was a lot of things that I needed to look at in terms of who I was. And then I said, okay, well, what do I really know? What do I really feel good about? I said, well, you know, I know baseball. You know, I mean, that may not get me a job, you know, but I do know the game. And I said, well, let me go back and see if I could interpret my life, you know, through the game. It's almost like saying, okay, I've reached this point of being 50 in my life. Do I know how to pitch? I may have been throwing all these years, but do I know how to finally pitch? And that's where I felt, you know, baseball began to be a working metaphor that I could use, you know, for a second memoir.
And of course, the fifth inning specifically refers to the fact that for people, you know, if you once you've gotten to the fifth inning, it's enough to call it a complete game. So even
Exactly.
if the game is called on account of weather,
Right.
it will go into the record book. So you're sort of implying, or maybe even saying overtly,
Right.
You know, if it all ends here, you've got this is a complete story.
Right, and then what you just say is that when you look at why many games are called, you know, many games are called is because of like rain, you know, in terms of bad weather, or sometimes maybe the lights go out in the stadium. But what happened, what I was looking at, was the fact that you have this overcast, you have this sense of bad weather. And so I would link that in terms of looking at the fifth inning as also a blues novel, because I draw very heavily on that. And so that's the connection, I think, in terms of the game. And for me, the fifth inning also represented the fact that I was, you know, entering my 50s. And I was looking around at how many people were not getting out of the fifth inning. You know, people were dying at 51, 52. And I said, well, let me further examine that. And so that's why I made reference to people like Ritika Vazirani, Liam Rector, people, dear friends who committed suicide. Because I think that as you live past a certain age, you begin to see many of your friends, you know, being affected by cancer, heart attacks, you know, suicide, and you realize that, hey, this may be a complete game, and you're just 49.
Right, and there's that sense of, you know, I think only as you reach a certain age do you feel that sense of your own mortality as the people around you that you grew up with, or people, this is what I've been finding, and I think you reference this a little bit too, because you talk about some people that I think both of us have known who were important mm-hmm. to us, who have died, who were older than we were. You know, the people who,
exactly.
You know, suddenly you're old enough so that the people who were your masters, influencers, the people that you, who are your teachers, now are old enough to really, you know, they're dying. And I think that is kind of, that changes your relationship, I think, to your own, the way you live your life. and
Exactly.
the way you think. And for you, I think a lot of this is a meditation. There's a lot of you're talking almost to the book itself. You're talking to us, the reader, in that outside of the narrative voice that comes up from time to time, where you're wondering to yourself out loud, like, what am I doing here? How does this really
Right.
work? And who am I? And I think that that only can happen. Maybe this is trite, but it seems only possible to happen once you've reached a certain amount of experience in your life, and then that magical or sort of semi-metaphysical point where you're able to say, I've lived a successfully, I've lived the greater portion of my life, and no matter how, whatever your age is going to be when the time comes, it's still going to be less time than you've already lived.
Right,
And
and
that.
then another thing I would say about the structure of the book, I was really creating a structure where the narrator was also drawing upon blogs, emails that I exchanged with people. I actually interviewed my son and daughter while I was working on it, and also incorporating their commentary into my story. One of the things I wanted to do with the blog references, I wanted to create what you see in a ballpark where sometimes the ads change, on
Yes,
the
yes,
scoreboard. And
yes.
so that I was very conscious of saying, okay, I wanted this to appear here like you would have in a ballpark.
Well, that's interesting too. I hadn't thought about it in that way, but it is a kind of replication also of the way internet communications work, and that is that you're present in the moment with so many different past moments. Everything is available to you.
Right.
We were talking just before we started recording today, which is we're on it's Sunday, April 29th, 2012, and we were talking about the fact that Moose Scourin died, the great, first baseman for the Yankees of the 60s, and the sense that you have today that's something that everyone will know about because of the internet. It's possible for information to be much more available to us. And
Right, right.
that's a challenge to the idea of the book that a lot of people are struggling with. And what you've done is really, I hadn't really thought about it in that way, that because you're referencing the present in the writing time, at the same time as you're referencing the past in the writing time, that you're compressing history and the past, present, and even the future, in a sense, in the way that you're writing the book.
Yeah, and one thing which I felt was the biggest challenge, I knew that because I was using baseball as a framework, that I had to have all the baseball facts exact, because people who are baseball fans, they're very so bad at 325 or 320, very exact. And
Right.
so I was researching everything, and how it was, and from being around books for a long time, there's going to be a mistake in there. And so what happened, I'm going back over all the baseball stuff, and there was one error which we just corrected in the paperback, and that is I spelled Cal Ripken's name incorrectly
Oh, no
in
kidding.
the heart set. Right,
Oh.
and that was the thing that I was going back, looking everything, I was looking up, and then I caught that, and I said, oh, this is a mistake here that I have to make sure I correct in the paperback, and that's what we did.
Well, the baseball references are all really great. I mean, let's talk about that a little bit more. You mentioned in here that Ichiro
Was my
Suzuki for
favorite, yeah.
Seattle Mariners is your favorite player. And maybe you could, I mean, as you try to describe how he plays, but what is it about him that makes him so special
Well,
to
you
you?
know what happened? I had this conversation. It was at the National Book Festival, and I bumped into George Will. Now George Will, is a conservative correspondent, conservative writer, but he's a baseball fan.
Right.
So I said, let me go up to this guy. I might disagree with his politics, but let's talk a little baseball. So I asked him, what did he think about Ichiro? And Ichiro had just come in the league. And you might recall people saying, well, he's too small, this and that, he's a little slapstick hitter, that type of thing. And what George Will said really impressed me. He said, he's the real thing. Or you go back to that moment in which at the All-Star game, Ichiro meets President Obama.
Yes.
And and Obama says, well, here you go, future Hall of Famer. You know what I mean? This guy, he's going to be the first Japanese player in the Hall of Fame. And I think that when you look at that throw that he made, it was like his first year from right field to third base,
Yeah.
and that was like a laser. I mean, no one had seen a throw like that from right field going back to maybe Roberto Clemente or maybe Al Kaline, you know. And that was the thing where I got caught up into what was his attribute that people really liked, where I was just dealing with the hitting. But what happens when you look at his fielding, his throwing, and his base running, you know, I felt that here is a complete player. And I just started watching him every game because I felt he was the one player that could perhaps hit 400.
Yeah, he might
You
have. I
know,
mean, he
that.
might have been able to do it. I think the only guy, you know, before him was probably Rod Carew, who
And
and
then
maybe George Brett. Yeah.
George Brett in it, right.
Yeah, but Ichiro had that capability because of his ability, just incredible speed and ability to slap the ball. Bat control is incredible.
But you know what the one flaw with the game was? The one flaw about, and this is what I've known people who work with him, is that he wouldn't walk a lot.
Right.
You see? So if you would just say, okay, Ichiro, just be patient, take a walk, well, that's going to keep that average up.
That's right.
You see?
Right.
And what happens is that, you know, he hasn't done, I think he's bounced back this year where the person put him down lower in the batting order, which now would have, he probably see better pitches, and he'll probably hit different because there's men on base. You know, I also was impressed by the fact that he would tell people that if you say, oh, you don't hit home runs, but if people could go to the games and look at batting practice, Ichiro can hit home runs. I mean, you know, he'll just adjust his batting for hitting home runs. But you know, it's amazing that he got down to technique. Okay, you want me to do this? I can do this.
Right. No, in fact, the thing that I remember about him that most struck me was one day I'm watching the Mariners play the Yankees. It's the ninth inning. Mariano Rivera comes in to save the game, and on the very first pitch, he took from Mariano a home run into right field. That showed me this guy could do whatever he wanted to
What he
do.
wanted to do,
You know, if they needed him to hit a home run, and it was one of those, it was like
literally.
a, that was a punctuation mark home run. It was like, okay, you are the greatest relief pitcher that has ever lived, but I'm going to hit you. And that was a great moment. Another thing you talked about, which I thought was really interesting, and although it was kind of interesting to me how you did this, you started out talking about the Red Sox, and but then you that sort of it really flowed into your youth as a you know a Yankees fan of the era that.
But I wanted to focus on that in terms of just how a person perhaps becomes a writer. I think I probably borrowed some of this probably from the poet Robert Pinsky, because I remember going to a talk and Pinsky was talking about how he became a poet, and he was attracted by the calling out of the stations in New Jersey, Hoboken, Teaneck, you know, this sound. And I realized, growing up, I remember coming in from the bullpen, Bill, Mom, Boo, Kit. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, if you want to get a sense of poetry and sense, like, you know, can I write like that? I may not be able to play, but can I have a name like that? You know? And they're like, Pumpsy Green, come on. You know, Pumpsy, I don't know where that comes from, but it's so nice, Pumpsy Green. You know, and so the Red Sox had all these names, Carl Yastrzemski, Tony Cosentino, that I said, wow, perhaps this was my introduction, you know, to poetry, to the beauty of language. And then I did meet, I was out at Foxcroft, the special private school for young girls in Middleburg, Virginia, and I was signing books. And, you know, you ask your children, you know, how to spell their name. And this young girl comes up to me, and her last name is Mambu Kit. And I said, wait a minute, are you ready to build Mambu Kit? Oh, that's my uncle. You know, it
That's
was just
great.
like, you know, she just like, oh, maybe, you know, it was so funny. I'm jumping, I want to get her autograph, you know. And she mentioned that, and I thought it was so funny that to meet somebody years later, and that name was still resonating.
Well, some names in baseball are great, but you also that led you to talk about a poet, Amos Zubolton, who you know who also has a great last name. But tell you mentioned, and this is something I had not heard about Amos pitching against Vida Blue. What was that story?
You know what happened? He made, you know, he was like the trickster. He came up with, I mean, and he's deceased now, but he was one of the master storytellers. No one knew whether he was telling the truth or he's making up stuff, you know. But I think down in Louisiana, you know, I think he did pitch against them, you know.
Maybe in high school or
And so
something.
something like that, yeah. And that was another person that sort of, you know, these pitchers that dominated for like a season or two. I think of Vida Blue, the same way I think of like Ron Guidry. You know, guys who for a moment, you know, that guy Strasburg is like that right now. And you don't know whether you're seeing the beginning of a remarkable career or one where it's just going to be one or two seasons
Right,
where
which
they're just that
happens.
dominant.
Right, it happens probably in writing as well as it happens in baseball. You know,
It's
you
the
got
first
somebody,
book,
they
right?
write that great book or maybe even two books, and you just don't know whether they're going to be able to sustain it or not.
Sure.
So you got, you know, they could be Mark Fidrich
Exactly.
or
Right.
Denny
And
Denny McLain.
right, pitches, exactly. You know, I mean that's a key thing in terms of those people who were just everyone was betting on them to win.
Right. Or, you know, the one I always think of, and this is a terrible story you probably remember, was Herb Score, great
Oh sure,
pitcher.
he got hit in the eye. Well,
Right.
Gil
Gil
McDougal
McDougall.
hit the ball.
That's right. And he had been, I mean, just an astonishingly great pitcher, and he never
Yeah.
was the same. So,
Never
I
been
mean,
the same.
it's probably no different. It's more dramatic when we see it happen with sports figures. You know, they're out in the public sphere. But I think that as you kind of make me think about as I read the book, that what you're talking about is life, not just, you know, it's not just metaphorically what goes on the baseball diamond. It's also, you know, it's directly related to us. And so there are a couple of things I just wanted to bring up. I mean, there was one thing that I thought was very sad, and you know, I kind of didn't know. I mean, I think you were working on it throughout the book, was the death of your brother.
And that carries over from the fathering words. I mean, that was, you know, I think in you probably could look at this in terms of your own family. There are these incidents, it could be weddings, it could be death, that just define a moment for a family. I mean, for example, we probably know that there's families right now where a parent got laid off, and that just changed that family's
Oh,
history.
yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, you look like you're a young child and you don't know what's going on, and all of a sudden you're moving, and all of a sudden there's less food in the refrigerator, and you don't know. But, you know, in every family, there is something. And I recall, I mean, I was very young. I didn't know what it meant for, like, my brother to go off to the monastery, you know, and the impact that had, or what discussions probably took place between my mother and father agreeing to do that. You know, and keep in mind, this is an African American family in the early 60s. You know, all of a sudden, the civil rights movement is going on in one part of the country. You know, this is going on, and your son wants to go off and be Thomas Merton. I mean, that's not what you normally, see happening, in many African American households. So there was that happening in the family, and, I just didn't understand it. I'm still just trying to figure it out as I was writing the memoir.
So, how much older is he or was he than you?
My brother was 7 years older than me, and my sister was five. And so, these are your siblings that are older. You know, I always tell people that the relationship between one's parents changes based on age. When you're young, you're the oldest, maybe your father can throw you up in the air and catch you. When you come along later, maybe he drops you because he can't catch as well. So that's something to think about, in terms of within the family.
Yeah, I think it clearly the and it but it the older what happens to the older sibling when you're you know when you're the young one is visible to you in a different way than when it's someone closer to you in age.
Exactly.
And
And
so
see, you carry that in, if you carry that in as a baseball, that's the whole thing in terms of all of a sudden you know when someone's getting older and all of a sudden they can't hit the curve, or they're just they're just a little late, or what happens, the fastball just doesn't get past the home run hitters.
right.
You see? Or what happens, someone could lay down a bunt and you're the third baseman and you just can't beer hand it like you used to. You see? And that's the thing that, it's if you're scouting, you realize right there that you better bring somebody up or get somebody prepared for the minor league because so and so is just gonna have one more year. You know, and you can look at what was happening the last 2 years around Jeter. And now he's off to a really good start. But people are almost saying, okay, this guy should never been given this type of contract. Get him out of the shortstop position. And I think he's proven a lot of people incorrect, at least for now.
Yeah, but you, as we are, everybody knows, you can't beat time. And what happens to baseball players is eventually, except for Jamie Moyer, obviously, it catch. You just can't keep doing it. And
yeah, but for a little moment though, you can stop it. I think that's the fascinating thing, that for a moment, you hold the ball or something like that, or you step out of the basketball, and for a moment it stops. You can stop it. I mean, you step out and you can stop it right there. It's 3-2 count. Okay, I'm gonna step out of the box. You can't be doing that on a fast break. what I'm saying?
No, it's true.
And that's something.
Well, baseball is that is special in that way because it has the boundary of time, but you, as you said, you can stop time. It's not inexorable, and also, you can, if the game is tied, you got to keep playing. So,
right. and it's also one of the few sports in which, if you make a mistake, they mark it down. You made an error.
Right.
You made a mistake. You could throw the ball out of bounds, or you could get a foul in basketball, offside, but you did not make an error. what I'm saying?
That's true.
Just that word error goes into your, like back in the days when we were in school, say, that's going to go into your, David, that's going to go in your permanent file, error.
Well, and
you
if,
will
if,
never get a job
that's
again.
Right. Well, it does go, I mean, it, we and people keep track of it because it's fielding percentage.
Right.
So it is, and then, thinking about that for baseball players, every single thing they've done is recorded it's in the record books. There's almost nothing you can do in baseball that
and
isn't
that's
recorded.
What's amazing, right. And that's what's amazing about Ichiro, and I have to figure out, it might be also Joe DiMaggio. Look at the number of errors they made in their entire career.
Yeah.
Where you go through an entire season and you make two errors.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible.
And that's incredible, and considering the number of innings you're playing and the number of actual opportunities that you're getting in the field.
Right, and it's also it's not that they're not getting to the balls. One thing that
right.
your error rate is low if you don't have good range because you don't get to those balls to make the
right,
mistakes
right.
on them. But these guys, Ichiro and certainly Joe DiMaggio had range, mm-hmm. and
right.
They're getting to balls, so they're catching them if they're getting to them.
Right, and you're talking about not overthrowing a base or something like that. I mean, there's so many odd places where you could make a mistake on one play.
Yeah, well, some guys make two on one play.
Right on one. I remember Willie Davis did that in the World Series. What do you mean, like 3 hours in one inning?
Right.
I played the last game Sandy Koufax, I think, pitched. And Willie Davis really messed it up for him.
So maybe that's why he retired. It wasn't that he
right.
was tired of baseball. He was just tired of imperfection behind him.
Right, I think if I'm not mistaken, Willie Davis made like three errors on one play. I think he dropped the ball, then he threw it wrong or something like that. I think he, and then another one. I think he made three errors in one inning, but I know he dropped the ball and he made a bad throw. That was two.
Right.
And there was another one. I think he was like 3-1. Who's going to tie that record?
Well, doing it in the World Series too. That's the other thing.
Right.
These are moments of absolute. Attention to every single thing that happens. So if you
right.
you're in a highly charged atmosphere where everything you do is visible. I mean, I guess in that way, baseball is not the perfect metaphor for life because for most of us, there isn't an audience paying attention to every single thing we do like that.
Right, but see, that's where I very quick early in the book, I think it's on the second page, I make reference to that image. Of Jackie Robinson stealing home and Yogi Bear jumping up and knowing he's out.
Right.
That's a defining moment, I think, and perhaps in race relations, I can see Romney jumping up. I won the election, this type of thing where you look up and I'm just fascinated by that. And what you find today, not that many players attempt to steal home.
That's true. It's
so
very rare. Very rare today.
It's very rare. Or it's on a double steal or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I know. That's sort of the game. I mean, there are ways in which baseball has changed. But I love the beginning of the book, and I love that the section of the book, which is, it's actually chapter 8, where it's called the fifth inning, and you kind of do this meditation on baseball in a lot
Yeah,
of.
and that, and you know what? That was written before. That's the one part that was written before the memoir. I wrote that as like a prose poem, and that's where that stood on its own. And then I sort of said, okay, well, you know, it has this title. I'm gonna weave this into the actual text.
Well, it works very well inside the thing. The one place there, I mean, I love this piece, but I think the part I underlined is your description of the bunt, which I want to read because I think it was so good, and it's kind of emblematic of some of your writing. A bunt is a soft kiss off of a bat, a rolling tongue or lip wet with desire and nothing else. That was great, just great. I love the way you describe baseball there. It was terrific.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you this. You know, I'm so happy that you're here because, you know, I always thought, okay, how's this book going to resonate with the baseball fan? You know, because what I've been still dealing with is getting into the baseball fan. You know, so you know, I've started corresponding with Paul Dixon. You know, who writes the encyclopedia and stuff. He just did the last book, so he's like a real baseball fan. So you know, that's I really feel good. You know, interacting. Because I said, wow, you know, this is what I want to do with the paperback. Make sure that, you know, you can put it in your pocket, you know, like how you would in the old days, you
Right.
know, and get the book to somebody who says, okay, I can understand the memoir, I can understand it, but hey, I really like, you know, these passages, these lines and stuff like that. And I had a few people who really said, you know, oh, this on such and such page is what resonated with me. So I'm really happy with in terms of your take on the book.
Well, it did work for me in that way. I mean, as I said before, lots of underlining, lots of places where I thought it was just the language is terrific, but also things that resonated. One of the other things that I thought was interesting is the theme of eating Chinese food in your family. That maybe you could talk a little bit about that because it comes up a lot in the book.
Well, it is true, and then I think this might be my interest in film, you know, because one of my favorite movies is The Godfather. And, you know, throughout that entire film, people are always eating. Like, you know, somebody's going to get whacked when somebody hands a glass of wine to somebody. But then when you have the actual, they're holding up during the gang wars, and there's this shot where they break away, they're all eating Chinese food. You know, they're all held up in this place eating Chinese food. I've always walked around with that image, you know, and keep in mind that in terms of my household, that was one of the things we ate a lot of Chinese food, you know.
So maybe that just kind of that's
It just wove in here, and
right, but
I
it's
like
also
mimicking.
it's a one of those memory things, a kind of a base for remembering things about your family,
Exactly.
and maybe I think probably certain restaurants or certain kinds of food that makes sense that would be resonant, as a kind of it's a almost like a memory device at a certain point that you can use to think of the food that it gets you entry into the memories of the
Yeah,
people.
and that's what I do in Father and Work, where I tell people in the beginning in that memoir, I tell people everybody's house has a certain smell and sound. You know, you
Yeah.
think about that, you know, there's a smell and a sound, and I talk about how in terms of music, there was a battling, like dueling banjo, like my brother liked classical, my sister likes R&B, I was into Paul Simon, so you had these different sounds coming out of this house. But it's the same way in terms of, you know, you're in an apartment building, and if you've got different ethnic groups, you know, you smell that when you get off the elevator,
Right.
you know, when somebody's cooking, and that defines your sense of home.
Yeah,
And
that's
you come
true.
out of college and you head back, you know, you before you open that door, or you as soon as you open that door, you're hit with your mother's cooking and that dish that you're not, even if you're on a meal plan at a college, you're not getting that smell, you know.
No, I think people
No
feel
matter how
that.
much tuition you're paying, those are
Well, so
the smells of home.
what do you think is the your kids, what are they going to think about in terms of
That's
their
going to be
memories?
interesting because, you know, my wife's a very good cook, and you know, we look up. I think she makes some of the best Mexican food. You know, I don't. I mean, I'll have to ask my kids whether there's a taste and a smell when they come home, that is home for them.
Yeah, I want, I'd never really thought about it that way because I agree. I thought about the smell memories that I have. I can remember my grandmother's apartment, that because she was baking all the time, and the other
Baking,
grandmother, no baking, but it would be
no
different kinds of
baking,
food. But every, you're right. There is this sort of feeling of recognition, and but it never occurred to me to think about what my own kids would have as their identification with our house.
Again, and what happens is how things are changing once you leave the house. So, for example, I go back, and we go back, okay, we were eating hot dogs and stuff like that. Then it came into all of a sudden you're eating tacos and enchiladas. Now it's hummus and falafel. You can see the changing eating habits of Americans as we deal with the diversity.
That's true. Oh no, that's that, and actually, there's a the expansiveness now. You were talking before about, walking into an apartment building and all the smells, and that's sort of the, classic for cities. It doesn't work in the country, but if you grew up in any city or if you had relatives in cities, that's a recognizable thing. Walk into the apartment and you smell cabbage, so you know that
That's
there's,
exactly Polish,
Germans, Poles. But now I think, but even then, or up until recently, the food in America was in at least the public food, not the food in people's homes, but the public food was fairly narrow in range. And
Yeah, and it's no longer that way.
no, not at all. Now, in fact, so the these your what you're thinking of there is that the smell memories that people have of food and their food experiences of the kids who are growing up today much broader than we ever had. So it would be it's going to be much more complicated for them. Because the cuisine at our at your home, if you were long time ago, would have been your background cuisine. But in the last 30 or 40 years, the cuisine you cooked at home might be much broader. As you're saying, it we might have made Mexican food, or and we've made Chinese food. We've made Vietnamese or Thai food. I mean, people are cooking those foods at home, not just
And then you
buying.
have the whole thing of interracial marriages increase, so you get a mixture, depending
Yeah.
on what day you show up at somebody's house.
Yeah, that's true. Now that's a really interesting discussion. It may actually be somebody else's book could come out of that. Well, I want to just thank you for doing this, but I also before we close, I want to read one other thing from a little section that you had that really resonated for me too, and that is because we're talking about food right now. A good marriage is a good meal. It's the food that turns cold long before the sex and love. Do you have enough? Do you have enough? I thought that was beautiful. So I want to really compliment you, Ethelbert, on a beautifully written book and really
Oh, thank
complex
you very much.
and.
And coming from you, it means a lot.
Oh, well,
Because
thanks.
I've always, over the years, I've always admired everything that you've done for literature, and I know you read a lot of books. So, for you to say this about mine is definitely something I really am deeply grateful for.
Well, I appreciate that, but I think I want to recommend people to read this book because it is really it's a great experience and really unusual. I mean, I think not linear. If you're looking for a linear story, this is
Right,
not
not
going to be the, that's not this book. But I think if you just want to enter a kind of a space of literary beauty, I think this is a place for that. I've been talking to Ethelbert Miller, the author of The Fifth Inning. It's a memoir, a beautiful book. And this is David Wilkes for Writer's Cast. Thanks, Ethelbert.